Good morning, everybody. What a great morning it is to be together, to be celebrating together. It's very exciting. Easter is here. He is alive. So, I want to ask you a question. Could I have my slides up, please, Jürgen? Thank you. If you were a fruit, what sort of fruit would you be? A pear. Okay. Has anyone ever been asked this sort of question before when you're like in a team bonding meeting? Maybe it's if you were an animal, what would you be and why? Anybody been asked that sort of question before? Yeah? I'd be a cherry because I'm small and sweet. Just kidding. You'll be like, she's a sour one. Okay, so today's morning, the actual question I want to ask is, if you were a king, what type of king would you be and why? Well, today, actually, I don't think any of us are going to be kings in this room. I mean, there's potential, but it sounded like all of us are going to be kings. So we're actually asking that question of Jesus, because Jesus was the king. And so what type of king was Jesus? Well, we're going to look at that this morning together. But first off, I need to ask, what is a king? Can I ask some of our kids, what is a king? Yeah, perfect. Someone who rules over your country, who keeps the helps keep the rules and do all that sort of thing. They, thank you. Sorry. Hello. This is even better. Can you hear me better now? Thank you very much. Okay. So yes, you're exactly right, Arthur. A king is someone who rules. They're in charge, aren't they? And they set the kind of the law of the land, and they make sure they look after their people. But how they rule is really, really important, because I'm sure if you think about history and also Disney movies, there are some very good kings, really great kings, loving, kind, compassionate, cared for their people. And then there are some really terrible kings, aren't there? Yeah, King Candy, he's a bit rogue, he is. Okay, so how you rule as a king is really, really important. And this morning we're going to discover together what type of king Jesus was. Now, kids, this is the bit that we get you running around the hall looking for things. So hidden around the hall, there are pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. How many pieces are there, Adam? 12 pieces, in theory, we'll find out. So kids, hidden around the room, there are pieces that look a bit like this. Can you go and find all the pieces right now as quick as you can and bring them to the front and try and put the puzzle together? Adults, if you can see any, feel free to assist and prompt. Oh, we've got a piece already. Well done. Brilliant, Adam, bring it back down here. Good boy. This is a classic family service. Let's hide something around the room and get the kids to find it moment. So I hope you're enjoying this. Excellent. Fantastic. Can you put that down there? Good boy. Any more? We're doing really well. Let's see. Let's hope Adam didn't hide them too well. Well done, Zaki. You found one. Very good. How many one? We've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. So we've got a few more pieces to find. Adam, did you hide them very, very well? There's one hiding up high. Oh, I'd be out of that. Oh, fantastic. Thank you, Serena. Right. Oh dear. Right. Someone, Adam, could you get a cloth for the juice on the floor? Thanks so much. So I think there's one hiding up high somewhere. Ah, well done, Caleb. Well done, well done, well done. Okay. So can you have a go at putting the jigsaw puzzle together? I'll give you a clue. We're talking about kings, and kings wear something on their head sometimes. You know what it is, Reuben? What is it? It's a crown. Well done. But written in that crown are some words that describe what type of king Jesus is. Okay, how are you getting on? Should have had some like elevator music. Boom, 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 boom. We could practice. While the kids do the puzzle, we're going to practice at Church of England Easter greeting. He is risen. Guys, we've got a way to go if we're going to beat the C of E. Okay, it's he is risen. He is risen indeed. Hallelujah. Okay, ready? He is risen. Oh, we're going to give those Anglicans a run for their money. All right, there we go. Right, how are we getting on? We're doing pretty well. Adam, you might need to give them some help because you've done very, very good jigsaw puzzle. Pointy bits. It's always about the pointy bits. If anybody can name all those kings at the end, you get brownie points. I actually Can't remember who they are, so I'll just nod and say, yes, well done. I know who the cartoon ones are. Classic. Okay, so they're doing very well. Oh, they're doing very, very well. Nearly there. I might put a little sneaky thing up on the screen that shows the adults what they're, oh, this is just a puzzle, what the words are going to be that they put together. Very good. I think Adam is doing really well at the puzzle that he created. Round of applause for Adam. Well done. And he's having help from little Adam, so that is very good. Okay, well done. They've created the puzzle. If you want to come and have a look at it later, you can. It is a bit like that, with all the words of what type of king Jesus is. And we're going to look at just a few of these this morning because we haven't got loads and loads of time. Now, back at Christmas, if you remember, I did a talk that was all about the promised king. I talked about the fact that Jesus was promised for a really, really long time, and some clues were given by God to people to go, this is what he's going to be like. He is going to be born in Bethlehem. He's going to live in Egypt. He's going to be betrayed for money. He's going to save people, and he is going to be a king. And we looked at the fact that there were lots of different people in the Bible that ticked a few of these boxes, but nobody ticked all of these boxes except for one person, and that was Jesus. God promised the world a king. Right from the beginning in Eden, the world was broken by the decisions of Adam and Eve. And God said, I'm going to send a king who is going to fix it. I promise you, someone is coming. And God always keeps his promises. Now, around Easter, we usually look at the events in the Bible in the week leading up to Easter. Now, if I was to stand here and wave this and go, Hosanna! Hosanna! And rip it just like that. That's what happened in real life too. Kids, can any of you, thank you very much, remember what story that might be linked to? People, yes, Reuben. Yeah, fantastic. Jesus was on a donkey and he was coming into Jerusalem. And people were like, oh my goodness, this person that was promised for such a long time, he's finally here. He's finally, finally here. And if you've been waiting for something for hundreds and hundreds of years and it finally happened, would you celebrate? Yeah, I mean, I think palm branches is an unusual form of celebration, but I like it, you know. I like the fact that they wanted to honour Jesus and they wanted to put those palm branches, they wanted to put their coats down on the road so that the donkey that he was riding on wouldn't even touch the road. They were celebrating the promised king. Excuse me. There you go, there's a little clip of that. They're very, very excited. So straight after this celebration, a slightly strange thing Jesus goes and does. Okay, he goes into a temple and he starts flipping over tables and knocking money off and kicking cages to let birds free and whipping, you know, things, people and things and making a bit of a stir. And this story feels quite out of place because we're used to Jesus, that, you know, the nice, pretty chill, you know, turns water into wine, heals people, loves people, really kind, really compassionate. And this seems quite out of character. Now, kids, if you go into Sainsbury's and you start swiping things off the shelves, you will get in trouble, okay? Don't do it. So why the heck is this Jesus that we look up to and we love, why on earth is he suddenly flipping out, literally? Well, the reason that Jesus started doing this is because in the temple courts, he saw that people were getting ripped off. He saw that people who wanted to come and worship God weren't able to because they couldn't afford to buy the things they needed to in order to worship God. In fact, this was in the court of the Gentiles, and it meant that actually there were so many people in there selling and buying and doing other things that it meant that they couldn't even get there to worship God. So Jesus was mad. He was angry. He goes, this isn't fair that people have come to my Father's house to worship and yet they are being stopped from doing it. And that is why he started flipping tables and kicking cages and doing all those things. Because he has such a sense for justice. He wants everybody who wants to come and worship God to be able to do that freely. Kids, even though Jesus did it, don't start flipping tables, okay? Fantastic. Now, a bit later on, Jesus, oh, this is him flipping some tables. It's the only picture I could find. They don't do it in cartoon form. Who knew? Okay, a bit later on, Jesus, he realizes that he's about to die. And so he goes off to a garden and he kneels down and he prays And he says, God, if there is any way that you can stop what is about to happen happening, if there's any other way that things can be fixed without me having to die, then please let that be the case. But if not, God, would your will be done and not mine? And he wept. He cried. He sobbed. In fact, I think in one gospel it says that he was so stressed out, he actually sweat blood. Okay. Now, what this is showing us is that Jesus is human. He came down to earth as a human. He experienced human emotions. Who here is sometimes really happy? I'm a bit sad there's not more hands than that. Wow. This side of the room is a very unhappy bunch. We need to do something to cheer them up a bit later. Who here has ever been happy? Hey, still not lots of them. Oh my goodness, okay. They're like, you will not bully me into telling you I'm happy. Who here has ever been really sad? Yeah. Who here has ever been really angry? Yeah. Who here has ever been a bit all over the place and all three at once? Yeah, there we go. You see, Jesus came to earth and he was human. He had fingertips. He had toes. He had hair. He had armpits. Not always. Okay, fair enough. Hair's not important, Mark. I agree. Yeah, okay. He slept. He ate food. He probably had his favourite food. He probably had food he didn't like. You know what, kids? He probably even occasionally did popsies because he was human, okay? Everything that we experience, Jesus experienced as well. And that is why he is not only a just king and he is not only a promised king, he is a human king, okay? So when he came and he did all this stuff for us, he did it completely as we are, you know, feels pain, feels emotion, and goes through all of those things. Now, kids, we are going to go out and we are going to discover two more types of king that Jesus was. So if you are in River Kids or River Tots, that's primary school or even a little bit before primary school, we are actually going to go out into that canteen over there and we're going to go outside and we're going to do a bit of an egg hunt and we're going to have lots of fun. And adults, you are also going to stay inside and you're going to learn what type of king Jesus was. And then towards the end, we are going to come and we are going to reflect together and we are going to worship the king of all kings.
So we are going to continue on with our kingly themes, moving on from where Beth left off. And we're going to be looking at our broken king and our risen king. So in Matthew's gospel in chapter 16, we reach a point where the penny drops for Simon and the rest of the disciples at the same time. He reaches the conclusion that Jesus is more than just his rabbi, that he's even more than just a prophet, that he is, quote, the Messiah, the Son of the living God. Now, if you were a first century Jew, this is the moment you've been waiting for. The promised king has arrived. Jesus is the Messiah, the one generations of Jews have been waiting for years and years and years and years and years, and he is here. Now, most likely, as a first century Jew, what you would assume to happen next would be that that Jesus would clear out any other would-be messiahs and any other rulers in Jerusalem and then around the world. And most likely, what you assume to happen is that he would have to get rid of Caesar and the Roman Empire. He would need to get rid of Herod the Great down in Jerusalem. He would need to go to the Sanhedrin and the temple court and clear all the Temple Mount because it was all corrupt and in the Roman Empire's pockets. So you do this in a really pretty straightforward way. You start to march south from Galilee down to Jerusalem and you rally an army en route. And you pray and you fast, just like Joshua did in the Old Testament, and then you attack. You overthrow and you usher in the new kingdom with the new king of Jesus installed as the new king. This is exactly what the disciples were expecting to happen. And it's exactly what happened, right? Jesus mounts his donkey and he just, wait, what? He doesn't do that. You see, Jesus had in mind the exact opposite of what Simon and the other disciples expected to happen. Jesus' next steps were, yes, to go to Jerusalem, and yes, to face the Roman Empire and the Jewish leaders, but not to be kill, but to be killed. You see, this is the broken king. And this broken king just wasn't really an option for the disciples at the time. A crucified Messiah is like an oxymoron. It's like saying a defeated victor. And it's just not part of their war plan. It just doesn't make sense for them. It's so clear to us now in hindsight. But in that moment, Simon Peter begins to rebuke Jesus. And if you open your Bibles to Matthew chapter 16, we're going to read a bit of this together. In fact, can I have someone to read if I flick the slides?
From that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, the chief priests and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed, and on the third day be raised to life. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. "Never, Lord," he said. "This shall never happen to you." Jesus turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me. You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." Then Jesus said to his disciples, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will find it. What good will it be for someone to gain the whole world, yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul?"
Thanks, Mark. Even after this is the first time Jesus had explained it so clearly to his disciples, but even after this, they still didn't get it. And if you continue to flick through the rest of the gospel, Matthew records at least four other occasions where Jesus had to lay out the plan yet again, reassuring his disciples that this is the way and it's the only way, that the Son of Man must suffer and die, but on the third day be raised from the dead, just as Isaiah prophesied 750 years prior. By the time Jesus was crucified, we have recorded in all four gospel accounts that his disciples had witnessed three individuals raised from the dead, that he'd walked on water, that he'd cast out demons, he'd calmed the storm, he'd fed 5,000 people on a boys' packed lunch twice, and performed many, many other miracles and miraculous signs and healings. I still don't get how they had doubt in their rabbi's plans. Let's jump forward. We're going to go back to the Garden of Gethsemane. Oh, that's a really dark image. Which is where Beth was saying he went and prayed. And on that night of Jesus' betrayal and arrest, here we find our King on his knees seeking God. He's in anguish and he's anxious, asking, "Is there any other way?" Jesus knew what had to be done. And of course, he knew it led to the cross. But he was chatting to his dad about it. And his father was with him. So as we go on, I've got a question. On the cross, why does Jesus say, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Because at first glance, it sounds like despair and abandonment. But you see, if you were in the crowd that day and you were an Israelite, a Jew, that you would recognize that line instantly. And it's the opening line to Psalm 22. Now, in our Bibles, it's really helpful because we've got chapters and verse markers in there. People back then didn't have verse markers and chapters in their Bible. These kind of appeared in the 13th and 16th centuries. But how did individuals point each other towards scriptures and certain passages and scrolls and books? They quoted the first line of what it was, and instantly everyone would understand what they're referring to. These Jews had the Old Testament committed to their memory. They knew. So as soon as Jesus said that, my God, why have you forsaken me? Or I can't pronounce it. Then they would have instantly gone, oh, Psalm 22. But it's more than just that opening line. When they quote the first line, it's understood that they're talking about the passage in its entirety. So when Jesus cried out these words, he wasn't just expressing anguish. He's pointing those around him to the entirety of Psalm 22. Yet, this passage begins with forsakenness, and by the end, it's filled with hope. God has not hidden his face. He has heard. The poor shall eat and be satisfied. Future generations will be told about the Lord. In other words, Jesus isn't saying, God, you've given up on me. He's saying, this hurts, but God is still here, and this isn't the end. Even in his final breaths, Jesus is preaching. Even on the cross, he's reminding us that there is still hope. And that hope has a name, and it's Jesus. Well, what does this hope look like? What happens next? I don't know about you, it still gives me goosebumps. Our broken king becomes our risen king. He conquers death. But this isn't for Jesus' own gain. Jesus didn't need to die a sacrifice for himself. He was blameless. And he didn't do it to show any power or authority or anything like that to show off. No, his death was for us. This is the final sacrifice needed between the barrier of us and our Father, between us and time with our Father in eternity. The good news, the gospel news is this. God has come for you. He knows you by name. He came to us in Jesus. He made a way for us to apprentice under him and follow him in just the way that an early disciple described the life that is truly life. That was Timothy. In Jesus, God has taken our death and given us life. He has taken our brokenness so that we can take on his healing. He's entered our mortality so we can step into his immortality. And all we have to do is say yes. Jesus says, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. Whoever. Meaning you don't need to be the best of the best. You don't need to have it all together. Thank goodness. You can be deeply wounded. You can be stuck in cycles of addiction. You can still be full of doubt. And you don't know what you believe. But in other words, you can be human. And all of us are invited to apprentice under Jesus, to take up that call and follow him. Come, follow me. We're going to go back in some worship in just a minute if the band want to come up. To be clear about this, picking up your cross is an idiom for dying to yourself. It's about laying down your crown in order to follow Jesus and letting him be your king. Laying down our crowns is about choosing to be not to be in charge of our own lives, but submitting to God's rule and God's reign and God's authority in our lives. And we're going to have an opportunity in a bit to lay down our own crowns before the cross as a physical response, as an act of saying yes, or yes again, a recommitment. And I encourage you all to do so. But we're going to pause. We're going to reflect for a bit. We're going to be thankful and recognize what our King has done for us on this journey, our broken King becoming our resurrected King, and the reason why he did it, which is for us.